This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll listen to some speeches given by Law and Disorder co-hosts at this year's Left Forum.
This was the largest gathering of progressive scholars and activists in America. You'll hear Michael Ratner and me, Michael Smith, put the police state tendency of this country into historical perspective.
We'll talk with Elaine Jones of the NAACP Defense Fund.
The death penalty. The United States is the only advanced country in the world that still has it.
We'll also hear from Collective Soul and Suzanne Vega at Amnesty International's Make Some Noise concert.
Sublime comments from musicians on human rights and musical expression.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
We go now to excerpts from speeches delivered by co-hosts Michael Ratner and Michael Smith at this year's Left Forum. The Law and Disorder panel was entitled 10 Minutes to Midnight. A reference Michael Smith explains later parallels the current legislative and judicial direction of the United States to similar police state tactics employed by Nazi Germany.
The theme of this year's Left Forum is Dangerous Times, Global Resistance and the Decline of Empire. And you'll see on the cover of the program the outline of an eagle falling. Well, I don't quite agree, and I take some responsibility for this because I was on the program committee, but I don't quite agree with all that this program says. I certainly agree, all of us do, that it's dangerous times. There is some global resistance out there, particularly in Latin America. But I can't agree with the notion of decline of empire. I think that the notion of the eagle falling is wrong. I think this program should be upside down, and the eagle should be ascending. This empire may be in trouble in the long run, say, with respect to what's going on in China or eventual challenge from India 40 years from now, but there's nothing declining about this empire. And it hasn't been declining since the overthrow of nationalized property in the Soviet Union in 1991. It gave it a new lease on life. It set the designs of the rulers of this country on Iraq, which they've brought forward. They've set up new bases surrounding the Caspian bases. They want to control oil around the world. Their neoliberalism project is far from dead. Their military spends $464 billion a year. This is not a declining empire. As we all know, you can't have an empire abroad and democracy at home. And that is the essence of what we're going to talk about today. We're going to talk about the profound constitutional crisis that we find ourselves in living here in the United States. The title of our panel, 10 Minutes to Midnight, The Emerging Police State, was suggested to us by a magazine that is put out by the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. The magazine first started coming out in the 50s, and it addressed itself to the fearful problem of an inevitable nuclear war. And as the United States grew more and more reckless in its nuclear policy, the clock on the front of the organization's magazine, which was set at 11:45, kept moving closer to midnight. And I think that's certainly true today, not only of nuclear holocaust, You see the United States just selling nuclear technology to India. That clock is advancing. It's advancing ecologically, obviously, and it is certainly advancing with respect to our constitutional rights. 10 minutes to midnight is actually the wrong title. Congress passed, what was it, 88 to 10, Heidi? 88 to 10, they passed the law extending the Patriot Act. 10 minutes to midnight is the wrong title. At this point, it should be 9 minutes to midnight. And who knows what it's going to be next week. And that's what we want to talk about. Because a police state doesn't emerge overnight. When Michael and I were working last year on the book, The Emerging Police State, it's a collection of writings by the great constitutional lawyer William Kunstler. And I edited the book with Kunstler's two daughters, and Michael wrote the introduction. And when we were talking about the title of it, we thought perhaps The Emerging Police State, that's a little shrill, maybe we should calm down. Too much, the emerging police state. But you know, in retrospect, we're absolutely right about this title, because that's indeed what's going on. The final solution wasn't announced as the final solution. The final solution came later. It should have been more accurately the initial solution. Things creep up and creep up. There's a law that you won't find in the New York State codified laws or in the federal laws, but a law that I think applies to what I'm talking about. It was Hegel's first law of dialectics, that quantity eventually turns into quality, that something that is only possible eventually becomes inevitable, that if you put salt on French fries, they taste pretty good, but if you put too much salt on the French fries, you can never eat them again. And that's the direction that we're going in. Things are becoming irreversible. The example that I'd like to give is the example of an obscure Austrian house painter named Schicke Gruber. You know who I'm talking about. Huh? They name people like this. Schwarzenegger is a fellow countryman of Schicke Gruber's. He was an Austrian who became the dictator of Germany. But he didn't become the dictator of Germany overnight. The Weimar Republic, the constitution that the Germans had that was set up after the First World War, was the most democratic constitution that had ever existed in the history of the world. Within a dozen years, it was shattered. How did that happen? Hitler didn't take absolute power initially. In fact, he was appointed legally Chancellor of Germany by a feeble, ailing, elderly German aristocrat. Hindenburg appointed him chancellor. At that time, his party did not have a majority in the Reichstag. The German parliament had 41%. The next strongest party were the communists. They had 35%. The Nazis staged the burning of the parliamentary building, the Reichstag, the symbol of German unity. How did it work? Hermann Göring, one of Hitler's top functionaries, took this half-mad young Dutchman from his house through a tunnel to the Reichstag. They carried with them two cans of kerosene, and the Dutchman set the Reichstag on fire and burned it down. They then staged a political trial, and with the Dutchman, they tried the leadership of the Communist Party. The leadership of the Communist Party had nothing to do with the burning of the Reichstag fire. You know, just as, say, Lynn Stewart, in her representation of the Sheikh, had nothing to do with terrorism or the war in Iraq or the airplane flying into the World Trade Center. Nothing to do with it. They made an amalgam between the Communist Party and the crazed Dutchman, and they tried him. Now, in those days, Hitler had not yet cleansed the judiciary. He hadn't yet, to use a current reference, put a lot of Alitos on the Supreme Court. And the judiciary was independent, and the defendants had subpoena power. The head of the Communist Party who was on trial was Grigory Dimitrov, who was a Bulgarian who was the head of the German Communist Party. And he was able to defend himself. He didn't use an attorney. He used the subpoena power. He called Hermann Göring to the stand And he destroyed him on cross-examination. In fact, Goering walked off the stand before cross-examination was finished. And as he walked off, he whispered to Dimitrov, "I'll get you in the streets." Sounds like something Cheney would say. And indeed, they did. They didn't get him in the streets, but they executed him later. The Dutchman was found guilty. The communist leaders were not found guilty. In one of Hitler's initial reforms, he brought back guillotining in public, and they cut his head off in the public square, a public assassination, really. The Communist Party, however, was associated in the minds of the public, and principally the middle-class public, because the working class was organized in the Communist Party and the Socialist Party, but that broad grouping in the middle, the middle class, who were scared to death because of the insecurity in Germany, and despite the reality of it, the Communist Party was associated in the mind of the public with the burning of the Reichstag. Just like today, despite the reality of it, Iraq is associated in the mind of the public, certainly initially, with the burning of the World Trade Centers. Weapons of mass destruction, they threatened the United States. And it was this kind of fear that Hitler played upon. So when Hitler had 41% of the vote in the Reichstag and wanted to consolidate his power, what did he do? He issued two decrees in February and March of 1933. After the Reichstag fire, he was able to do it, and the two decrees gave him the power to legislate. The power to legislate. So you no longer had checks and balances in Germany, just like more and more we're not having checks and balances in the United States. And when you have a situation where the executive can not only execute the laws, but make the laws and call the armed forces of a country into play to enforce those laws, that is the definition of a police state. And that's what happened in Germany. And without being alarmist, that is the process that's going on in the United States today. One piece of this is the attack on the lawyers, the attack on Lynn Stewart, the making it impossible for lawyers to defend controversial clients. Mark my words, you may get a guy like Sheikh Abdul Rahman, who's a bad guy, but he's got constitutional rights, and lawyers like Lynn Stewart don't defend people, they defend constitutional rights first and foremost. And what the American government has done is they've taken away two powers. One is they're spying on attorneys representing controversial clients. You can't have a confidential conversation with your client now. They can do it without even a warrant. Ashcroft brought that in. Secondly, they're telling these attorneys, you can't say what you want to with respect to the situation of your client.
That was our co-host Michael Smith at this year's Left Forum, speaking on the Law and Disorder panel, 10 Minutes to Midnight. In the second speech, co-host Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, lays out a similar framework. He cites relevant Supreme Court decisions, the Patriot Act expansion, and a weak-kneed Congress as key stepping stones to a police state buildup.
I like standing for this, so. Well, thank you, and thank you all for being here. I was in Germany about a year ago, and I spoke at a place called the Hans-Litten Bar Association. We were filing our case in Germany against Rumsfeld et al. For torture, Abu Ghraib, Guantanamo, etc. And amazingly, the Bar Association of Berlin actually hosted us. And it was the Bar Association was called the Hans-Litten Bar Association. It was lawyers from East and West had gotten together after the wall had come down and formed this bar association. And they named it after a famous lawyer from the 1930s. Hans Litten was a lawyer who, prior to the Reichstag fire, had put Hitler on the witness stand to demonstrate that the Nazi party was a violent party. And he cross-examined Hitler for 2 hours. It was before Hitler took power. And in 1933, the night of the Reichstag fire, when Hitler took power, they arrested Hans Litten. He ultimately was tortured and died in prison, really, because of his political work. And I was thinking about Lynn, I was thinking that, you know, someday, hopefully, we'll have a country where we can name a bar association, not because of anything bad happening to Lynn, but in her honor, that we can name a bar association the Lynn Stewart Bar Association. But, you know, when we came in here, there's a lot of energy here, there's a lot of energy in the room. It's energy that, you know, we have to all put to use at what I consider to be an utterly critical time for the issues that I most work on, which are fundamental human rights and civil rights issues having to do with liberty. And I remember writing an article in October 2001, and it was called Moving Toward a Police State, or Have We Arrived? And I thought then, maybe that's too dramatic, because at that point, what we were facing, we had the Patriot Act in front of us, we had internal detentions in the United States, we had the lifting of the FBI guidelines that we had fought really in the 70s and 80s for, that came out of the fight over what had happened to the Black Panthers, the communists, going all the way back to the 50s and the 60s. And I saw what was happening in the country with fundamental rights. But at the same time, I thought it might be risky to talk about moving toward a police state. Was it really moving toward a police state? A police state to me is one in which there's no check on the executive. The executive wakes up one day, he decides to arrest you or you or you, he decides to bomb something, he decides to do whatever. It's really a dictatorship. And I said moving toward a police state, and that really became for me a crucial beginning of what I saw happening in the country. And since that time, of course, we're 4 years later, 4 years of these panels, and every single month, things get obviously much worse in terms of what the administration is attempting to do. In a few minutes today, just broadly bookend what I consider to be a couple of the crucial issues that make me convinced that this country is now, on many levels, become a tyranny. And we begin with not just what I said about in October 2001, shortly after 9/11, but I begin with the day I woke up and I saw on November 13th, 2001, that the president had issued what he called Military Order Number 1. Military Order Number 1 is the one in which the president said, I, as the president of the United States, can arrest, detain, kidnap, whatever your capture, whatever word you want to use, any non-citizen anywhere in the world. I can do that, and I can hold them forever. I never have to try them. I can simply hold them forever. And there's a part two of that order that says, well, if I ever decide to try them, we can try them with a special military commission, kangaroo court, whatever colloquial term you want to use. So you have this order. This is already in 2001. We've talked about it at prior panels. It's well known. It's based on the president's claim of commander-in-chief power. It's blamed on a view that he can do whatever he wants. I consider that sort of one bookend to what I call this moving toward a police state, or really tyranny in America right now. The other bookends, and I don't know what one will be there tomorrow, but the ones that have come up in the last few months, and then there's a lot in between from Guantanamo to Abu Ghraib, but the ones that have come up in between are the ones that took place on December 30th of last year, and of course the one that just took place recently having to do with spying, electronic surveillance. December 30th of last year, the president signed the McCain Amendment. I consider that the other bookend to tyranny. The McCain Amendment, as you may recall, is the one that bans cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, a form of torture. It was passed because the Congress said, finally, we're going to pass this. This has always been prohibited under U.S. law, but Congress said, we're going to do it again. They didn't do it in a great way, which I'll talk about, but they at least did it. It comes up to the president, and the president says, well, I never really liked this law. I didn't want Congress to pass this law. And I'm going to, in what's called a signing statement, I'm going to say what I think about this law. And I'm just going to paraphrase. It's one paragraph. But if any of you have any questions about whether or not there has been a coup d'etat in America, read that paragraph. You can't say you didn't know. What it says first that as the president, I can do what I think is necessary to protect national security, paraphrasing, even if it means torturing people. I call that the Pinochet defense. So that signing order took place. It says first that I can do whatever I want in the name
of national security, even torture people. Secondly, it says I can ignore Congress completely. I don't care what they do. And third, it says I can ignore the courts. So that's what I consider the other bookend. And in addition, of course, we have the bookend that took place at the end of, right now it's continuing, the national security wiretapping. And that, of course, is where the president believes that he has the inherent authority to electronically surveil any of us. The Center for Constitutional Rights, where I work, brought a litigation against that. Our plaintiffs in that case actually are center attorneys, because what our center attorneys do all the time is communicate with people all over the world or their families who this administration believes are alleged terrorists. Now, what you've seen, of course, is an utter laydown in Congress on this law. Any legal arguments about this law are utterly and completely ludicrous. There's no legal justification at all for what the president is doing. And in fact, in my first case that I ever brought at the center, the famous lawyer named Arthur Kanoy, it was a challenge to warrantless wiretapping under John Mitchell, and we held that unconstitutional when Arthur argued in the Supreme Court. And now, of course, we're seeing that again. So those are the basic bookends of what I consider to be essentially a tyranny in America. In terms of the facts that have happened in the last 4 years, of course, as probably a lot of you are aware, the center has been for 4 years now representing the Guantanamo detainees. And now we're seeing national calls to actually close down, worldwide calls, to close down Guantanamo. Now, what Guantanamo represents is first arbitrary detention, the idea under that military order, under the president's commander-in-chief authority, that you can do whatever you want to human beings anywhere in the world, pick them up, and put them in Guantanamo. We won in the Supreme Court the right to have those people go into a court. And then what happened, if you have any thoughts, 2 years of litigation later, if you have any thoughts about what our Congress did, Democrats and Republicans, I want you to think about Guantanamo. Because there we had what's called the Detainee Treatment Act. And 2 years later, after we get 500 attorneys to start representing Guantanamo detainees, people from all over the world, really, to represent people, all over the country, Republicans, Democrats, and others, what happens is Congress, Republicans and Democrats, pass the Detainee Treatment Act. And that's not only a serious kick in the teeth to our clients, that demonstrates the utter inability of our Congress to really deal with this current situation or willingness to deal with it. And what that act does is three things. One is it says the courts can't hear these cases anymore. The courts have no right to even consider why people are detained. Then it says evidence from torture can be used to keep people in prison. And the third thing it says is if anybody is tortured in Guantanamo, they cannot sue for torture. So recently what came up is one of our co-counsel brought a lawsuit. We brought one at the center, and another one of our co-counsel brought a lawsuit because people are being force-fed at Guantanamo. Huge, they're being strapped down. Huge tubes are being put into their noses. They're essentially being tortured through forced feeding. And what does the government come in and do? It says, well, we don't think this is torture. But in addition, even if it is, there's nothing you can do about it because our Congress has said you cannot do anything about torture. So we're facing, really, not just an administration run amok, but in many ways, a Congress that has been really a stepping stone or a step stool, unfortunately, for that administration. The second issue, of course, we've been dealing with is this issue of torture. And here's where I've actually been the most disheartened. I mean, it's clear to all of us that this administration authorized torture. There's memos out there. There's the John Yoo stuff. There's that whole set of materials. And in the last few months, I've been doing a fair amount of speaking around the country at college campuses. And what I can't get over, really, is the way in which torture has really seeped into the fabric of this society. So that students come up to me all the time, and they say, well, they always ask, the first question is, what about the ticking time bomb? Then another one goes up to me and says, I sort of agree with what Alan Dershowitz is saying. You shouldn't torture people unless you have a judicial warrant to torture people. But this is, you know, it's funny, and I want to laugh, and I want to wring the student's neck. But what's going on out here is you have an administration that says it, you have a Congress in its law that's authorizing it, and then, as I'm going to get to, you have a court that is beginning itself to say you may be able to torture in the interest of national security. So we're reaching a point in this country when the public discourse is really adopting as part of it that we may be able to torture people in the interest of preventing terrorism or national security. And that brings me to the case we just lost, this case called Mahar Arar. Mahar Arar, I'm sure you all know, is the Canadian citizen. There's a couple of recent Bob Herbert columns about him. He was the guy who was rendered, sent to Syria for an extraordinary rendition for purposes of being tortured. We just lost the case right over the water here in the Eastern District of Brooklyn before a judge named Judge Traeger. Judge Traeger was a former U.S. attorney, lo and behold, the head of the Brooklyn Law School, which makes it hard for me to believe he wrote the opinion that he did. But if you have any doubts about what direction this country is going, you have to read that opinion. He dismisses the case. He has to accept that Arar is sent to Syria for torture, and he accepts that. He says, even assuming Arar is sent for torture, I'm dismissing this case because national security doesn't allow me to hear this case, because when you get into this case, it may affect our relations with Canada, oh, a bunch of other BS in the case. But that's not the worst part of it. The worst part are 2 pages of the opinion, where he goes on and he speculates about whether the Constitution of the United States bans torture. And what he says is, yes, in a criminal case, you can't torture somebody. You're not supposed to, it's illegal, and if there's any evidence from torture, you can't use that in a criminal case. But then he goes on, and it's not even necessary for the opinion, he goes on to say, well, it might be different in a case in which you're trying to prevent terrorism, that the Constitution may not prohibit torture if the purpose of the torture is for the purpose of preventing terrorism. Now, this is a federal judge sitting in the Eastern District of Brooklyn saying that it may be that as a constitutional matter that one can use torture. So we're sitting here now in a country where we have an administration that, as we all know, has completely undermined any kind of controls, any kind of checks and balances, any kind of constitutional framework. We're sitting here with a Congress that, from the McCain Amendment to the Detainee Treatment Act I talked about, to what they're doing with national security, spying right now, has completely gone along and been, as I said, a step stool, really, for this administration. And now we're seeing courts do essentially the same thing. I want to give one story and then end, but one story. We had a panel the other day that was incredibly moving to me. It was a panel that went, it was called From 1973 to 2006, From New Orleans to Abu Ghraib, Torture. And it was 3 Black Panthers who'd been tortured in 1973 in New Orleans. And they told the stories of their torture, terribly brutal torture. And then some of our attorneys had been to Guantanamo and worked with our clients there, told the stories of torture in Guantanamo. And when I started thinking about it, I started thinking, what is really going on here? What is this government doing with torture, both here and abroad, and why? And yes, some people say, well, you know, it's a ticking time bomb, you have to get the information. Other people say it's vengeance. But when, you know, the Black Panthers were there with me, I began to think about how when I was a child, what the role of lynching was. Of course, the role of lynching, there are many roles that it may have had, but one of them was clearly to terrorize the Black community, to make it so that a Black man, a Black woman, a Black child could not walk down the street and hold their head up. So it was an instrument of terror. And when people ask me, Michael, why at Guantanamo are they torturing people if it's not getting them the information they need? Why are they doing it? I would say it's the same reason they were doing it to the Black Panthers in 73, the same reason they still do it to people in the United States today, and the same reason they're doing it for people at Guantanamo. It's really to terrorize the community, in this case Guantanamo, to terrorize the Muslim community in particular, to say to them, you oppose the United States, you have your dignity, and we will take you to Guantanamo, and we will torture you. The last initiative which I'll mention, which I'm sure most of you have heard about, is the Center's book, Articles of Impeachment Against George W. Bush. And, you know, at first, when when people, this did not originate, I have to say, the center can't take that much credit for this. Some people came to the center and they say, we want to write a book about impeachment. And we took our lawyers together, and in 2 or 3 weeks, we put this together. And what is remarkable to me, I'm, skeptical about this kind of stuff, because obviously on some level, here I am saying, forget about this Congress, and yet you got to get Congress to go ahead and impeach him. But I'm not looking at it that way. I'm looking at it as a way of saying, here I'm fighting a battle about Guantanamo, and what they're doing is then they have Bagram rising up over here. So I'm saying you have to put all of this together and look at this administration, whether it's the issues I care about, or that I, all of whom I care about, but that I work on the most, or whether it's Katrina or the war in Iraq, and you have to say this is a criminal administration, and you have to get rid of it. It's just the beginning, it's not the end, but it's certainly a first step. And what's remarkable is the program we did with Harper's was on C-SPAN, and the number of calls all over the country, literally hundreds of people all over the country who say, yes, go for it, we want to do this. And the polls reflect that. The polls reflect that something like 50% of the people in this country now think that if George Bush, which is like a joke saying the if he lied about the war in Iraq, he ought to be impeached, or if he warrantlessly wiretapped people, he ought to be impeached. So while I, in my life as a human rights lawyer, I've never seen a situation so openly and notoriously of a government taking power to torture, detain, imprison, and spy on people in my life. I've also think we're coming to a point where there's enough opposition in this country and enough fight back where we can actually get somewhere. Thank you.
That was Michael Ratner speaking at this year's Left Forum.
Thanks very much, Michael Ratner.
During Amnesty International's general meeting in Portland, Oregon, co-host Dalia Hashad spoke with Elaine Jones, president, director, and counsel for the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. She describes her early work on the seminal Furman v. Georgia death penalty case in 1972, and she lends inspiring words of advice to young attorneys.
This is Dalia. I'm here with Elaine Jones, legend in the anti-death penalty movement. She is a lawyer and president and direct counsel emeritus of the NAACP LDF and longtime lawyer in the fight against the death penalty. She was the counsel of record in Furman, which we've talked about at length on this show. That's the case that ruled the death penalty was arbitrary, capricious, and discriminatory. Heidi Boghossian discussed it just in March. So we're really pleased and honored to have you with us here, Elaine. Thank you for joining us on Law & Disorder.
I'm glad to be here, and I was a great death penalty team on Furman. Tony Amsterdam argued the case, Jack Greenberg and LDF, and I was a young lawyer 2 years out of law school and got to work on Furman for my first 2 years of graduation. It was marvelous.
That's amazing. And, you know, we actually have, it's a team, Law & Disorder is a team of four lawyers that we talk about activism in the law and activism in general, and we make those connections. And we get a lot of feedback from young lawyers out there. You having gotten involved and made such a historical impact at such a young point in your career, just 2 years out of law school, what is your message to young lawyers or people who are wondering, and when they get out of law school with debt, why did I do this?
Well, first, don't get sidetracked. Money is important. Now, money is a matter. Joe Louis, the great boxer, once said, you know, I don't like money really, but it quiets my nerves. So nerves need quieting. People have debts. They have law school obligations. So you have to be able to pay those bills. But when I say keep focused, I mean come out, go somewhere for a while, make some money, live within your budget. Live within the budget and save. You know, pay off that. You can't do anything to really help anybody when you've got debt, when your head's over heel in debt, especially a lot of credit card debt and what have you. Now, the good debt, of course, is college debt and professional school debt. But find a way to pay the good debt down. Don't buy the 2007 Lexus or BMW. You don't have to have that. Try to find some place to live that you can get a mortgage, a reasonable mortgage. And then you're in a position that you can go and use those skills, those legal skills, the way you want to use them. And that's what I mean when I say follow your passion. It's very important because it's a lot of travel, but the rewards is so fulfilling to be able to use this training we have to really make an impact on people's lives, a direct impact, something you can see.
Now, we had a tremendous year last year in the death penalty.
Yes.
Now, talk to me about where we need to go from here.
We have to make sure we're politically active. It's no accident what happened on the Supreme Court of the United States, because they want to make sure that 2005 doesn't happen again. You see? Now,
tell us what happened in 2005.
Well, 2005, you know, in 2005, we got the Supreme Court. It was the juvenile justice case. Mm-hmm. The Supreme Court decided that you can't give juveniles under the age of 18 the death penalty.
And cited international law, which was a cardinal sin to many people.
Exactly.
Don't, how dare you cite international law in the U.S.?
But that's why we got it's a court of public opinion now, that we've got every time someone comes up and attacking the justice, we need to speak up. We need to find our voices. You know, because we don't live in isolation. The Supreme Court would not be doing its duty if it didn't look around the world
and see
what other courts and other nations are doing.
Right.
How can we live in isolation?
Yeah.
You know, and so the law, and we are becoming, we talk about global society and the world of economics also, and we know we have our own body of law, and we have different traditions, but there are things we learn from others. And that's all the court is doing. The court didn't say, in saying that international law determines our jurisprudence, they're just saying we're looking to see what others are doing, which is reasonable.
Yeah.
Also, but there's a fear by many in this country that our law will expand to be inclusive of all of us. See, it didn't start out that way. Founding fathers, for all that they had going for them, made some mistakes. You know, they left out women, you know, left out black folks, left out Native Americans, left out white men who didn't have property. I mean, so they left out a whole lot of people. But they at least gave us a system whereby we could bring these people in. And so what we've been doing ever since we got the Constitution with the Bill of Rights in 1791 has been to be bringing people in. But that is a move afoot in this country. They want it restricted and narrow. They don't like our expansive view that it does include all of us. And that's what we're fighting with. That's why this ideological battle here, and it's very important. The nation that we are, and with the mix that we have, we're not the nation we were in 1787 when those guys met in Philadelphia. We're a different group of people. And so I think that our founding documents, the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, as Thurgood Marshall thought, is big enough to include all of us. And so that is what our struggle is about. Also, the humanism in the law. I mean, this Justice Ginsburg and Justices Brennan, and they all understood how demoralizing it is to us as an advanced society to execute people the way we do. I mean, it's barbaric almost. It's unconscionable. And that is something we have to come to grips with. It demeans us as a society. We are bigger than this. But I believe the law is evolving toward that. And it's our job to make sure it continues to evolve. And that's why the political, we have to be active. We also have to watch what's happening with the courts, not only the Supreme Court, but the lower courts. This judicial selection thing, the election of judges, all of it is critically important. And so we can't look at one and not the other.
And there's a human rights implication in who we put up on the court. And people, there's not a connect there.
These human rights issues and concerns is at the center of everything. It's who we are as a people. When I say people, I mean the American people. Who we are as a people, as a nation, as a country. I mean, it's our core, you know, and mouthing these platitudes, you know, about equality and social justice and doing something completely different, you know, letting circumstances of birth and letting issues of poverty put us in a position where we deny equal justice and fundamental rights to the least of these, it's a real problem. And Martin Luther King tried to help us. You know, and he gave us language and the guideposts and all of that. But now it's time for us to act and to hold those accountable who have a different view.
Thank you, Elaine Jones. Thank you so much for joining us on Law and Disorder. It has been a pleasure to hear you speak and to have you here at the Amnesty Conference. And then thanks for taking time to hang out with us, because there was a big line of people getting to her. I had to beat them down to get some time with her at the end of her talk. And I'm glad I'd won.
Thank you so much. I've enjoyed it immensely. It's good to be with kindred souls.
During the Amnesty International General Meeting in Oregon this year, co-host Dalia Hashad and producer Jeff Brady recorded a number of panels and interviews. Among them were several musicians who volunteered for Amnesty's Make Some Noise concert at the historic Roseland Theater. Dalia caught up with American songwriter and singer Suzanne Vega. Vega sat down for a Law and Disorder interview and spoke with Dalia about her music, human rights, and expressing these ideas through music.
Well, I'm here in the Roseland Theater in Portland, Oregon with Suzanne Vega, which I know will excite many of our listeners. And so, Suzanne, we're really thrilled that you took time out to sit with us and chat for a bit. Thank you.
Sure, no problem.
So Suzanne's sitting here with a Make Some Noise, a pink, great t-shirt, Make Some Noise, Amnesty International t-shirt, and she's got her matching Converse sneakers, looking very cute. Tell us why it's important to make some noise.
Well, I think the issue of human rights is a really basic issue. It's sort of, when I think of all the different causes that I could work for, human rights is the one that comes first for me. For me, all the other causes sort of come after that one. So I'm just thrilled to be here. I like to work for Amnesty, and I think this particular concert is to raise awareness of what's going on in Darfur.
Tell us why human rights comes first on the list.
How do I explain it? I believe that once you realize that every human has worth and every human has dignity and that really must be fought for and preserved, all the other values sort of come from that. That's what I believe. I mean, I'm sure people who work for other causes, you know, you shouldn't really rank them, I guess, but that's what I believe. And I think human rights is sort of, it's been the main piece of progress for the last century. I think one of the biggest things that happened was the actual coining of the phrase human rights. Beginning of the century, there wasn't that phrase. At the end of it, it's become something that people really know about, people believe in, and people are aiming for that standard all over the world. And I think that's it's just really important.
How do you think your human rights values and your social beliefs are reflected in your music?
Well, I think that when I started writing music, I wasn't particularly aware. It wasn't something I was trying to do. After the success of Luca, which is a song about a child who's been abused, that's when the human rights organization started to contact me and ask me, did I want to get involved? And that's when I realized that there really was a core of expression in the songs, that actually a lot of the songs are trying to express a feeling of dignity and worth for the individual. But that wasn't something I was aware of before Luca came out and became a hit.
So why did you write this song then? What prompted you to write Luca?
Well, it's an issue that has been around for such a long time, and people ask all kinds of questions. I mean, what I normally say is that I've known children who were abused, and I wanted to express that point of view, and it wasn't one that I had heard expressed before. So I found a way to do it that expressed the pain of the child without the child actually saying what the problem was. And this was a long time ago. That was about 20 years ago. And most people at that time really did. It was not an issue that people talked about in public. And so times have really changed.
Well, that really depresses me to hear you say that was 20 years ago, because I was just going back in my head and thinking about how, you know, when that song first came out, how I just loved it immediately, but not necessarily for its meaning. And I remember singing it over and over again. Yeah. And after a couple months, it stayed on the top of the charts for a while. And I remember after a couple months, really thinking, oh my gosh, I've been singing about child abuse. Right. Like, and this is a really sad song. Yeah. And the meaning came later.
Yes, I could see how. I think that was probably true for a lot of people, because if you listen to the song, the way it was produced, it sounds cheerful, or it sounds like... Yeah. But I wrote it a certain way. I feel that children who are abused, they don't talk about it, and they don't necessarily show the sadness that they feel. A lot of them are very stoic. They get up, they go about their lives, and that was the kind of song I wanted to write, something that had that quality to it. Actually, before I produced the song, it was a song that a lot of people didn't particularly ask for. You know, before it had the more pop arrangements. You know, I could see them looking at each other going, is she really singing what I think she's singing about? You know, so it was a surprise to me how quickly it was embraced once it was produced. And I realized it was because it was such a pervasive problem all over the world.
What special role, is there a special role or responsibility that you feel music has to social movements like human rights?
Well, I think the most powerful music is the music that comes from something, from things that are rooted in real life. And I think that it's not even so much a responsibility. It's just that the best music, I think, really does reflect where a person is in time. You know, when we think of Bob Dylan's music, or we think of Peter Gabriel's music, the reason it has that power is because it's connected to things that are real and things that are happening in society and with people. It's not so much that the artist has the responsibility. It's really more that if you're a really great artist, you tap into what's already there, and you bring it out, and you're in touch with it, and then you bring it out so other people can see what's going on.
So given our times, especially here today in the United States, as DJ, what songs would you play?
What songs would I play? I mean, there's such a range of music these days.
What particularly reflects your feeling of... the mood in the U.S.
Before I put this shirt on, I had my Foo Fighters t-shirt on. Yeah. I had my In Your Honor. Yeah. That album to me is such a powerful album. And I know that he got a lot of the music, the musical ideas from being on the tour bus with John Kerry. Mm-hmm. Dave Grohl did. And I think you can really feel a lot of the anger and the struggling that people are feeling in that record right now. I mean, that's a record I go back to if I'm feeling... frustrated or when I need to, like, give myself a good kick to get out of, you know, bed in the morning. I mean, that's the record I go and listen to. Both sides, the acoustic side and the rock side. Mm-hmm. So that's one that people might listen to.
Yeah. I think people need a lot of that these days. So to take us out, Suzanne Vega, what song of yours do you want to share with us right now, and we'll play it?
Oh, why not Tom's Diner? You may as well play the remix version, since it's people are still remixing it. I still get people requesting. The last one was like 2 weeks ago, so that one still seems to be living on and on. So you may as well play the remix of Tom's Diner.
Before we do that, we want to thank you for joining us on Law & Disorder here in the Roseland Theater. We're looking forward to the show tonight.
Great. Thank you so much.
We go now to a heartfelt interview with co-host Dahlia Hashad as she talks with Ed Ryan and Joel Kosh from Collective Soul, the alternative post-grunge band from Stockbridge, Georgia, and one of the headliners at Amnesty's Make Some Noise concert at the Roseland Theater in Portland, Oregon.
Hi, this is Dahlia from Law & Disorder, and we're here with Collective Soul right before the Amnesty International General Meeting Make Some Noise Conference in Portland, Oregon. We're really excited that you guys hung out to talk to us. It's raining outside, and as we came through, we saw a line forming about 4 hours before the concert, people waiting to see you guys, or fans out there excited for what you have to say.
In the rain,
yeah, and with no cover, sitting in the rain. So thanks so much for joining us on Law & Disorder.
Oh, thank you so much for having us. It's an honor.
Yes, thank you.
Tell us
us what's so important. Both you guys are wearing Amnesty International Make Some Noise t-shirts. Tell us why you're affiliated with Amnesty.
Well, we want to do what we can to raise awareness for the situation that's going on in Africa, which is, we were just getting kind of enlightened earlier today about, I mean, you hear about these crazy things over there, and I don't know, I guess since we're, you know, just in our, living in our nice comfortable homes over here, it doesn't really strike you as hard as it should, really. So that's why we're here. We want to try to raise awareness. You know, hopefully people will tune in a little more over there.
Same thing Joel said, you know, just make people aware to try to change things. It's funny, you live in the 21st century, and this kind of thing you think you see on the History Channel, and it still goes on in today's world. It's sad. It's what it is. And to me, it's our job, because we're blessed people over here in the United States. It's our job and our duty to bring awareness that, you know, not everywhere is safe and secure and easy of life as we have it. And these people are... need all the help they can get, and just bringing awareness to what's going on in that region is it's the least we can do.
As musicians, why have you chosen to participate? Do you think that musicians have special ability to add to this discussion or to bring awareness?
That's a tough one, because I generally, you know, stray from like very like straight political views that I have to get my political agenda out there. I don't. I think of it as I'm a musician first, and to me, this is a social thing as much as it is a political thing. You know, I mean, it's just a human thing. So
it's a human thing. It doesn't matter what your occupation is. Once again, you're talking about innocent people dying. That has nothing to do with what category we fall into in our job description. That's humans there, and that's, like I said, in today's time, we should be a little bit more sensitive and try to do what we can to help that situation.
And what do you hope will come out of people like you speaking up? What is your ultimate goal? Is it just to end the genocide there, or do you have a larger hope?
I mean, of course you'd like to start there, but you'd like to stop all the wackiness that goes on in the world. I'd like to stop it that's happening in this country, to be honest with you, you know. We are without sin here, and so I'd like to straighten some things out here.
Yeah, let's talk about that. That's actually a particular interest of ours on the show. My co-hosts obviously aren't here in Portland, but we have the lawyer who headed up the whole Guantanamo litigation, representing all the people down there. The executive director of the Most Radical Lawyers Association is with us, one of the hosts. And so we work on the United States as well as the rest of the world. Tell us what you think is going on in the United States that needs changing.
I think truth from the main White House would be a start, first and foremost. I really do, you know. And then we can go from there. And I think it's important right now, especially with the midterm elections coming up, that people, I don't care what party you vote for. I just want you to vote for someone that's honest and that has a heart. And I don't think that's hard to find. I really don't. So I'm really hoping we can get some things turned around a little bit in the midterm elections and kind of straighten things out to a more honest country, because there's nothing wrong with being honest, you know. It's just not. And letting the people run the government again, not some secret, I can't get too crazy, some secret men in Washington, you know, making choices that have no bearing on what truly the people want.
I think that's one of the things we discuss a lot, and that we're particularly concerned about. So much of what's happening now is happening in secret, and it has no bearing
on truly what the people want. If you were to ask the people what they wanted on half the issues that have been going on in the last 6 years, I truly can't say 6-7% of them would agree with it. You know, and that's, once again, I thought this was for the people.
I guess I essentially agree with what Ed's saying. Yeah.
Well, that's good. That's good to be in agreement. Mm-hmm. How about your music? Does any of your music speak to your social consciousness?
What we try to deal with is spirituality. And I think if you can start there, I think you're going to be a pretty happy person, which in turn, you'll want your environment to be happy, the people that surround you to be happy. So we're not the kind of band that takes direct hits at governments or agencies or anything like that. But we do try to make, you know, more uplifting, make you feel better as a person. Once that happens, then I think you can spread and make your surroundings, your environment, your friends, I think you can make your whole world better. I truly do. So that's where that's the side we come from. Because we're from the South, so it's a very smothered type religion there, if you know what I mean, without getting too. And we love to see what other people are. And I think it's good for people to realize that all religions truly are about love. It's not, no one religion is, you know, people get so infatuated that there's certain types of religions or these cats with backpacks running around blowing things. It's not. That's not. You could take extremists in any organization. You could take it in policemen, and you know, not all policemen are bad, but we don't ever hear about the good ones. All politicians aren't bad. I truly believe that, but you never hear about the good ones. Everybody's about love. If you really dig down into every religion, it's really the ultimate goal is love.
There's also so much political music about freedom and political prisoners and people struggling to be free.
Mm-hmm.
And
even, that's what's so funny to me is we can't even comprehend that because we are so free over here. You know, we don't even think about the freedoms we have. We're just numb to it. And we expect it, all freedom, you know, and there are people still in the world that they don't have that. And it's just disheartening.
And I wonder if, you know, you brought up a good point earlier about things happening in secret, and I wonder if the reason that a lot of people don't realize that some of the freedoms we take for granted are disappearing is because we have been so free and it's happening secretly.
We've been so free and we've allowed some people to be too free in their little locked doors making decisions.
We got to change that. And that's a great message to end on. I'm gonna let you guys play DJ for a second. Tell us what you want to play from your music, your collection.
Yeah.
Ooh, let's play Better Now.
Yeah.
Let's do Better Now.
That's a great choice. Collective Soul, thanks so much for joining us here on Law & Disorder.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
If you would like to hear Law & Disorder on your local or campus radio station, please contact us through our website, lawanddisorder.org.
The ideas expressed here on Law & Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.
Oh, shiny and clean. From your recent adaptation. Time to redefine me. Shaking the world's done shaking me down. The world's done shaking, the world's done shaking, the world's done.